begins at 5. The expanded forecast, dry but pleasantly cooler weather for the weekend with highs in the mid-70s. Right now, mostly sunny skies and 70 degrees. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for the Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In commemoration of the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 successfully landing on the moon, PBS's series American Experience is airing a magnificent documentary called Chasing the Moon. 6 hours long in all, airing in 3 parts, A Place Beyond the Sky, Earthrise, and finally, Magnificent Desolation, telling the story of the tireless efforts of both Americans and Soviets to reach the moon. Many fine documentary films have already been made about the space race and the race to reach the moon, but none can touch this film in terms of its scope and thoroughness. I was privileged to be able to record an interview with Robert Stone, who wrote, produced, and directed this film, again titled Chasing the Moon. Mr. Stone, one of the challenges it seems to me that you faced in putting this amazing documentary together is to tell a story that has already been told so many times, somehow in a new way or with a new sort of thoroughness, maybe not seen before. What kinds of things did you think about as you began this project in terms of making it more than just a retread of what we have already explored and experienced in previous films?
Well, I didn't, that's a great question. I mean, I didn't start this project thinking, I want to make a movie about Apollo. How do I do something different? I was motivated to do this because I thought there was an aspect of this story that to me was the most important aspect that I'd never seen in a documentary before. And that really is, you know, what it was like here on Earth to live in a time when we were leaving the planet for the first time and going off to another world. I was 10 years old when we first landed on the moon, and my entire childhood was lived in anticipation of this event. So it was, you know, really a huge part of my childhood growing up in this world when, you know, we were doing this bold and audacious thing, and there was no certainty that it would all work out as it did. And just what that time was like and how it impacted us here on Earth. I think the story of the astronaut experience has been told many times. I think that's generally been the focus. And I think all too often the story has been told in isolation, as if, you know, it's just an adventure story. Yeah. And I don't think you can really understand why we went to the moon, what it was about, or glean any meaning for it for today's generation without understanding the context in which the whole thing took place.
So right.
I thought there was an opportunity to do something new and interesting and to do something that's, you know, as epic as the adventure itself, which is why, you know, the film is 6 hours. It covers the entire history of the race to the moon.
Right. And now I understand better why one of the first quotes we hear in the first part, A Place Beyond the Sky, is when somebody talks about how one of the greatest things about the whole space program was that everybody felt like they had a piece of it. And everybody, meaning not just those directly involved in the space program, but even the civilian population had an amazing sense of being not just observers, but somehow even participants in something so grand and exciting.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I think as much as going to the moon was a technical challenge, it was also an incredible challenge for NASA to sustain political and public support over the course of a decade with multiple administrations for this project, and how they went about involving us all and making us all have us feel like we had a personal stake in every success and every failure was unique. For a government agency, and really made the space program something that resonated with everybody all over the country, and in fact, all over the world. When the Apollo 11 astronauts came back and toured the world, they went, I think, to like 23 different countries in the course of a month after they returned. And everywhere they went, there were signs saying, "We did it. We, the people of Earth." There was a real sense that it wasn't just two Americans up there. It was emissaries of the human race. So the way that NASA was able to make us all feel a part of this was a huge aspect of what that made this story unique.
Hmm. One of the sort of bread and butter nuts and bolts decisions that you had to make as the writer and producer and director of this documentary was, in a sense, how much time to spend with various chapters of this story. And I have to say that one of the things I most deeply appreciate about this documentary is that you, in a sense, do not rush us to the moon. You spend a considerable amount of time in all that leads up to Apollo 11. Can you just say a word about, as a filmmaker, the kind of choices that confronted you in constructing this film and in deciding how much time to spend, how many images to show, how many words to write about the various chapters of this long and complicated story?
Well, I wanted to have this be a very human story. I didn't want it to be sort of an encyclopedic history of just of each mission going up. I wanted to place the story in the context of the of key people who played a huge role in making it happen, and to show how the whole idea of going to the moon developed, how that idea was then sold to the American public as something that wasn't just a science fiction fantasy, but something that could actually happen, and then the circumstances of the Cold War and the challenge with the Soviet Union, who was our arch rival in international affairs at the time, our competition with that country really paved the way for this adventure, which was designed to showcase America at its best and to show to the rest of the world that we were the wave of the future, that liberal democracy was the wave of the future, and come with us, we're going to take you to the stars. And the Soviet Union was doing the same thing. And that was the impetus behind it. So there's a lot of time spent explaining this and showing how this developed. I'd say probably the most, the one character who we profile who goes through all three parts of the film, all 6 hours, is Wernher von Braun, who is one of the most fascinating characters of the 20th century, former SS colonel and Hitler's war machine, who developed the first ballistic missile and comes to the United States after the war, develops the ICBM for the United States, but who has dreams of orbiting space stations and colonies on the moon and colonizing Mars and sells this idea to the American public, seizes an opportunity when the Soviets get ahead of us with the first satellite, Sputnik, and convinces John F. Kennedy that the way to beat the Soviet Union is to move the goalpost and commit to doing something so audacious that the Soviet Union could never catch us, and that was to go to the moon, and he felt that he could develop the technology to do it. Of course, nobody knew how to do it, but he thought maybe if he had the resources, he could do it. This was his childhood dream, and he seized the moment. Kennedy was convinced. He thought this was something that would marshal the best of America, as he put it, and off we went. But you can't understand the moon landing without understanding this whole fascinating history that led up to it.
Right.
It's not just an adventure. It's not just like climbing Mount Everest or something. This was a huge collective effort. And in fact, 2% of the American workforce was in one way or another involved in this effort. It was absolutely extraordinary.
Right. And I so appreciate that you include in part one a really dramatic newscast that I don't remember ever seeing before. I'm pretty sure it was Douglas Edwards, a familiar name in television news back in the 1950s, a telecast on October 6, 1957, talking about Sputnik. And at that point in time, almost nothing was known about exactly what Sputnik was or what those beeps meant, what kind of right. signals were being sent. But I think you do a marvelous job of, in a sense, taking us back to that moment, which was so frightening for Americans who did not begin to understand just what this was about, but whose sort of collective imagination leapt to some of the most frightening of possibilities.
No, that's exactly right. And, the way that we constructed the film, there's no talking heads. We did audio-only interviews with about a dozen people who were of sort of a diverse cast of characters. It's a fully immersive in footage from the time and contemporaneous news accounts, so you really feel like things are unfolding before your eyes.
Absolutely.
Without the sort of seesaw going back and forth from the present to the past, or having it be sort of a nostalgia trip looking back at the past. It unfolds like a thriller, a real sort of real-time adventure story.
I completely agree. By the way, in the telling of the story of our race with the Soviets, such a ferocious race for so many years, I am so appreciative of the fact that one of the voices we hear is that of Sergei Khrushchev, the son of Nikita Khrushchev. I actually had the privilege some years ago of interviewing Sergei Khrushchev on this program, and I feel like his contribution to your film is invaluable because he offers such insights and very honest appraisal of what the Soviets did right and also of what they did wrong in this space race.
No, he's an extraordinary character. He was by his father's side throughout the whole early history of the space age. And he was also a leading Soviet rocket engineer in his own right. And it's kind of extraordinary that he's never been interviewed for a space documentary. It's just amazing. And he's got incredible stories to tell, one of which is that President Kennedy wanted very much to do a joint mission to the moon with the Soviet Union. Both he and Khrushchev were appalled at the spiraling costs and the duplication of effort. They both wanted to wind down the Cold War. And about a month before Kennedy was killed, Khrushchev actually agreed to do this. And then, of course, Kennedy was killed, and Khrushchev was overthrown about 6 months later, and it never came to pass. But it's one of the great what-ifs of the space age, is what would have happened had we perhaps done a joint mission to the moon, and how that might have changed the course of the 1960s.
Right. Your film points out and shows us so many of the firsts that were part of the Soviet efforts, the Sputnik, of course, being the first, and then the first man into space, Yuri Gagarin, the first woman into space, Valentina Tereshkova, the first multiple crew to go into space, the first spacewalk. All of these were Soviet accomplishments. In talking about Yuri Gagarin, one of the things I appreciated was that we saw so much of him, and not just footage from inside that the vehicle that took him up into space, but you also tell the story of Gagarin on the ground once he had landed successfully. And what a charismatic figure he was, with a beautiful wide smile, and paraded all around the Soviet Union. I mean, he was a charismatic, charismatic celebrity in so many, many ways. And that, I'm sure, in many ways only kind of worsened America's sense that we had fallen behind.
Absolutely. Well, this happened barely 3 months into Kennedy's presidency. And Kennedy was absolutely desperate to do something to show that America was first. He campaigned on, you know, rejuvenating America's prestige and spirit around the world. And here the Soviet Union, which we had thought of as some sort of backward country, had completely beaten the pants off us in getting into space and putting a man into orbit. And that's when he started to cast around and said, you know, how can we find something that will beat them? And the answer came back, well, you really can't. They've got bigger rocks than us. They're way ahead of us. You just got to move the goalposts. And it was Wernher von Braun, I spoke about earlier, who convinced Kennedy that the ultimate goalpost, would be to send a man to the moon and do it by the end of the decade.
Right.
So that's what Kennedy did.
That's such an interesting insight, and I want to make sure I understand it, but it seems like a very important point. We often think about this space race with the Soviets as just one long, continuous space race in which they started out quickly and then somehow faded as we surged into the lead. But in fact, when the decision was made for us to go to the moon, in a sense, it was a decision that meant we were embarking on a new race that would involve profoundly new technologies. I mean, of course, a lot of it built on what had already been developed, but it was just the fact that this was not going to be the same race. It was going to be, in a sense, a different race, and the Soviets, in chasing us, would have to, in a sense, do the same kind of restart as we would. And the hope was, and maybe even the confident hope was, that we could win this second space race. Is that a fair way to summarize it?
No, absolutely. Going to the moon was so much more complex than putting a man in orbit. Both countries would have to build an entirely new generation of rockets, you know, orders of magnitude more powerful than what currently existed. There were materials that would have to be invented that nobody knew about in order to return into the atmosphere at those high speeds and returning to the front to the moon. And then orbit, you know, linking up two spaceships in orbit was something that nobody had ever done or knew how to do. That would have to be accomplished, and nobody actually knew the method of how to get to the moon. Nor was there even public an outcry and public support to do this. I mean, this was really a great example of leadership pointing the way, saying this is the goal, this is the time frame, and then going out and convincing the public and Congress to support this and sustaining that over a long period of time. The myth is that this was all generated by Kennedy, and he just gets up and gives a speech. Congress appropriates the money, and NASA just goes about their business and goes to the moon. And it was so much more fascinating than that, and so much more complex. And the ultimate outcome of it was in doubt all along the way.
Absolutely,
it's just a far more complex story than has really the public really knows about.
And I so appreciate the fact that this is an expansive enough documentary, 6 hours in length altogether, that this is a complicated story which you do not have to rush us through. For instance, your film is the first time that I have ever seen such an extended excerpt from that famous speech that President Kennedy gave, in which he says so memorably, "We choose to go to the moon not because it is easy, but because it is hard." But I had never seen any of the rest of that speech, and in that speech he reveals so much about kind of the central purpose of it, and one really gets a sense that this was not just about generating a headline, but about much more than that.
I'm so glad you pointed that out, because I completely agree. That particular clip has been used again and again and again. But if you see the long extended sequence of it that we use in the film, you really get a sense of being there, what it was like to be there in 1962, listen to President Kennedy make the case for going to the moon. And as you're right, it's far more expansive and emotionally moving than just that famous one line. And so, yes, having the liberty to do this over the course of 6 hours really allowed us to dig very deep. And, I have to also point out, most of the other documentaries that have been done about this have largely relied on the NASA collection. And we went way, way, way beyond that. We got a lot of NASA footage in there, but we went into, I think, nearly 100 different archives to source footage for this documentary. So there's lots and lots of stuff in here that nobody's ever seen and heard. And we were able to also, synchronize. We found sound recordings, and we were able to synchronize it with footage. We got some other speeches of Kennedy that Kennedy made that nobody's heard since the day he gave the speech, because we were able to synchronize sound and picture. So there's a lot of new, fresh things to see.
Incredible. Do you have time for a couple more questions?
Of course I do, yeah.
Let me reintroduce you. I am so pleased to be speaking with Robert Stone, the writer, producer, and director of a sprawling documentary called Chasing the Moon, told in three parts, A Place Beyond the Sky, Part 2, Earthrise, and Part 3, Magnificent Desolation, which tells in amazingly thorough fashion the long and complex story of how man was finally able to make its way to the moon. One of the stories told that I did not expect necessarily to be told in such rigorous detail was the whole matter of PR and journalism and NASA's sort of open-door policy when it came to journalists, and a fair amount of openness when it came to what was being done. And I suspect that part of the reason for telling that story is to strike yet another point of striking contrast with the way the Soviets conducted matters within their own program. Can you say a word about the significance of all this and why it plays such a significant role in your film?
Well, the race to the moon really was in many ways a war of visual imagery. It was a propaganda war. Without visual imagery, without television, it would have played out very, very differently. And the approach that NASA took was kind of unique for a government agency, which is to let it all out there as much as possible, to let successes and failures play out, so that if there was a failure, it was not just NASA's failure, it was our failure. If there was a success, it was our failure, our success. And so that's what captured our imagination. I remember as a kid, you get up in the morning and you'd watch the rocket launches and you're at the edge of your seat. Is it going to work? Is it not going to work? Because it was all playing out live, including ultimately the landing on the moon, which was a live television event. And that's what it was, the live television event, the fact that this was broadcast all over the world, the first global communication satellite network that we have today, the first element of that being successfully linked went up 2 weeks before the Apollo 11 moon landing. And this was the first global broadcast all over the world of a television broadcast. And that technology developed at the same time as the space program. So we've got, the miniaturization of television cameras. You remember, they're huge. The global satellite communications and the ability to broadcast live from the moon is what made that event so memorable. And I think that's the key thing that we deal with in part three, that I think is different from other tellings of this, whereas it's not just the experience of the astronauts going to the moon, which we tell indeed, but it's how this played out and how we all felt a part of it, and all felt for a brief time felt our common humanity and a sense of global unity that I don't think has ever happened before or happened or has happened since.
Hmm. Well, and I appreciated an earlier point in the film, just ahead of the launching of Alan Shepard's flight, which was the first American into space, although not into full orbit. It was suborbital. But back in May of 1961, your film tells us, or at least suggests, that President Kennedy played a hand in the decision for Alan Shepard's launch and flight and splashdown to be carried on live television, despite the concerns of some that it was very, very risky to do so. And I found all of that just so interesting to think about those kind of decisions being made, and also fascinated at the thought that the president of the United States would have a hand in how that ultimate decision was made.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, there'd been famously the first American satellite launch after Sputnik had blown up on the launch pad spectacularly and had been a terrible humiliation to the American government. It's one of the reasons I think Kennedy won the presidency, is there was a sense that we were, you know, the Russians were having these successes and our rockets were blowing up on the launch pad. I mean, not all of them were, but that was the general public perception. And so here we have Alan Shepard going up less than a month after the Soviets had successfully launched the first man into orbit. And the prospect of losing an American on the launch pad in an explosion live on television would have been just absolutely impossible to imagine how dreadful that would have been. So it was a huge risk, and President Kennedy was personally involved. He called down about an hour before the launch and talked to von Braun and said, you know, just wanted assurance that the escape rocket that was mounted on top of the capsule in case of an emergency would actually work and what the chances are. And von Braun said, you know, we've got a 98%, I think, success rate with that rocket. And I think we can do this safely. And President Kennedy said, okay, let's do this live. And once they did that, all the rest of the launches were always live. And he saw that what a huge impact this had in the American public in supporting the program. Mm. And that sort of set a template for everything that followed.
Mm. One thing that I knew nothing about until I watched your film was the story of Edward Dwight.
Yes.
Who was on track, at least as far as some people were concerned, mm-hmm. to perhaps be the first black astronaut. First of all, I'm very curious to know how you yourself even knew of the story of Edward Dwight. Maybe this is a story that's well known in certain circles, but I, who have followed the space program fairly closely over the years, did not know this name at all, or his. Ultimately regrettable story. Tell our listeners about Edward Dwight and how you first knew of his story.
Well, when I started this film, I knew nothing about it either. We came across, in our course of our research, this incredible story about how the Kennedy administration had wanted to recruit an African-American astronaut into the early astronaut corps as a way to bolster its record on civil rights, to enhance the civil rights movement, which was happening at the same time, and also, excuse me, to as I was saying earlier, you know, part of what Kennedy was doing with the space program was to showcase America at its best for the rest of the world, and to have a black astronaut as part of the astronaut corps would have been hugely beneficial to America's image abroad. So they did a search and they found this guy who was a ace fighter pilot. He had an advanced degree in aeronautical engineering. He qualified, and they sent him out to Edwards Air Force Base to train with Chuck Yeager. Anybody seen the movie The Right Stuff will remember that story of the astronauts training as pilots and the astronaut training that went on. He went through that whole program, and he's got just an amazing story. Ultimately, he was not selected, but he was a huge celebrity in the black press for a while. It was announced that he wasn't going to be an astronaut on television, and he thought he was going to be part of the Corps, but it turned out he was not selected. There was a lot of reasons for that. Racism certainly played a role. But it's, again, one of the great what-ifs that's been forgotten because it didn't pan out. And I think, you know, so many of the interesting details that have been lost to history come from, you know, looking back and saying, well, this happened, this happened, this happened, then we went to the moon, and forgetting all of the things along the way that didn't pan out this way or didn't pan out that way that are absolutely fascinating.
Right, that are worth exploring.
Ed's story is one of them. Absolutely, because that was what we were experiencing at the time. That's what made it a story. I'll tell you another one that I think is another amazing story that we found that's been completely forgotten, is that during Apollo 11, one of the great dramas was the Russians' sort of last-minute Hail Mary to beat us to the moon. And they, about a day before Apollo 11 launched, the Russians launched a robotic mission to go to the moon and land on the moon and scoop up soil and then return it to the Earth before Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong could come back with their soil samples, sort of a man versus machine thing. And this was part of the entire news coverage of Apollo 11, and what made was one of the things that had us sitting on the edge of our seats. And within an hour of Armstrong and Aldrin landing on the moon, it was announced in the media all over the world that the Soviet spaceship had flown right over the Eagle on the lunar surface, and it landed 200 miles away and was on the surface of the moon 200 miles away from Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong. So everybody's wondering what's going to happen. And it turned out shortly after Armstrong and Aldrin left the moon, returned to the command module, it was announced that they'd done some telemetry readings and realized that the Soviet robotic spacecraft had in fact crashed into the lunar surface at 300 miles an hour and had failed. But the part of the drama of that whole experience was this question about what the Russians were doing. And because it crashed, because we found out later it failed, it's been erased from history. You won't see it in any documentaries. You won't see it in any books. It's been lost. But it's one of the key dramas of what made Apollo 11 so exciting.
Incredible. And yes, a story that even those of us who have followed this story fairly closely over the years have heard nothing about until your remarkable film. Another thing I learned from your film was that there were competing schools of thought in terms of how we should reach the moon. And actually, the aforementioned Wernher von Braun had an idea in his mind that ultimately was discarded in favor of the mission mode that was chosen of launching from the Earth and going straight to the moon. Just briefly explain to our listeners this other notion of how this should be done that Wernher von Braun had formulated, which looked completely different and is so intriguing if such a plan had in fact been followed.
Well, if anybody who's listening who's seen the famous film by Stanley Kubrick, 2001, that film really depicts what von Braun had in mind. He wanted to not just go to the moon. He wanted to go to Mars. He wanted to go to other planets. He wanted to create a whole system that would send humanity out into the solar system and into the universe. So he wanted to build an orbiting space station, which would be the place where spaceships to the moon and the planets would be assembled and then go on from there. And that was the initial plan that he had devised. When Kennedy set the goal of doing this by the end of the decade, it became clear pretty early on that there was no time to build a space station. That the whole focus was simply, let's put a man on the moon. At that point, is if we can just land one man on the moon and bring him back, we'll achieve President Kennedy's goal. And so the space station was dropped, and they came up with this idea of which was called Lunar Orbit Rendezvous, where you would have two spacecraft go to the moon. One would be specially designed just to land on the moon and come back, and then hook up with the mothership, which would return them to Earth. And that was eventually what was decided upon. And the current plans to return to the moon now basically follow that same path.
One of the things that's really interesting as you tell us about this is you show us what appears to be one of the very first press conferences where this, it's what's called, I think, the basic mission mode, explaining that to the public with small little models of the various crafts that would be involved. And as we watched this, I just remember thinking, if I had been watching this at the time, I would have been entirely unpersuaded that this was the way to go, just because it looked incredibly complicated that you launched this thing. You launched this thing.
Nobody had ever rendezvoused two spacecraft together. Nobody even knew how to do it when they proposed this. So it was quite radical. That's another example.
This is a monthly test of the Southeast and South Central Wisconsin Emergency Alert System. In the event of an emergency, this system would bring you important information. This test is now concluded.
Found it's an incredible, beautiful color film. We were able to find the sound and synchronize it, and that's never before been seen. It explains the whole, there was their first explanation to the public about how they thought we might get to the moon by the end of the decade. Hmm.
I want to just spend a moment talking about perhaps the darkest moment in this whole period from the point of view of the United States, and that is the tragedy of Apollo 1. I don't want to say too much. I really want our listeners to experience this as I did just watching your film. Suffice to say that you depict this tragedy, just to remind our listeners, of a fire that occurred on the launch pad during a test with the Apollo 1 rocket, and three astronauts were killed in that tragic fire. And you depict this tragedy in really extraordinarily vivid fashion. I wonder if you could just say a word now as a filmmaker about what you thought about in trying to depict this moment in a way that would be incredibly vivid and yet sensitive to the dimensions of this tragedy.
Yeah, well, it was a very, very tricky scene to build because it's a deeply emotional moment in the film. We get to know some of the key characters involved beforehand. And there is an audio recording of from inside the capsule as the fire happened that I don't know if it's been used before.
Not that I have ever heard or seen.
I don't believe it has. It's chilling. Deeply troubling to listen to. So crafting a sequence in which we use that respectfully and in context that I think does justice to the moment, and we've shown it to people who were directly involved in that, and they've been very happy with how we handled the whole thing. Was very difficult. I wouldn't have used that tape unless we'd found a way to use it in a way that's respectful and not gratuitous. But it is. I think you're right. I think it's one of the most powerful moments in the series, and really shows the element of danger that these astronauts faced, which it's easy to forget because so much of Apollo just went so well. You know, it's kind of amazing that it did, which did lead to a certain level of complacency later on. But I think it's a key moment in the film.
Absolutely,
I think, and one of the most emotional. You know?
And in the wake of it, I think your film also does a really good job of helping us wrestle with, in a sense, who was responsible. was this a necessary or an was this an understandable and necessary tragedy, or was this something that was senseless and pointless and not necessary? And of course, that's a matter that can be thoroughly debated. But you share film footage that I've never seen of one of the most familiar voices and faces during this period, newscaster Walter Cronkite. And you include in your film footage of Walter Cronkite reacting to this tragedy in a way that struck me as very, very thoughtful. Do you remember the moment I'm talking about?
Yes, absolutely. Well, Cronkite, you know, was a key proponent of the space program and was really its most vocal and notorious cheerleader, who was personally knew these astronauts personally, was very emotionally connected with the whole program. And when he goes on television that night that the fire happened, and basically says that, you know, America has got to be prepared. There are going to be accidents, and these pilots knew that that was a possibility. And he says that we need courage. And he says, if that sounds trite, I'll change the word to guts. He's almost in tears, and it's a very powerful moment. And you know, the program itself, might very well have been canceled at that point. There was declining interest in the race to the moon, the tragedy, really, people were starting to question, well, why are we even doing this? And it was people like Cronkite and others, astronaut Frank Borman and other people who were able to persuade the American public, no, we're going to fix this problem. We're going to be open and honest about what happened. We're going to fix this problem and move on. You contrast that with the Soviet Union. One of the problems they had, one of the reasons they didn't make it to the moon, is because when there was a problem, people were afraid to come forward and say so. So they had disasters that might have been avoided had they had a more open flow of information, and people felt comfortable coming forward and saying, "Hey, this is a problem." And I think that's a lesson for any kind of business, maybe even for Boeing, you know.
Absolutely, they were in a sense incapable of really fully learning from their own errors, because
exactly,
their errors had to be so quickly, in a sense, suppressed.
You didn't get a promotion if you came forward and said there was a problem.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Well, ultimately, of course, your film also suggests that the tragedy of Apollo 1 was also perhaps instrumental in certain fundamental flaws being corrected, and that original Apollo 1 spacecraft, somebody in your film suggests, would never have made it to the moon safely. And this tragedy, such a painful setback, of course, is also, in a sense, a catalyst to what ultimately is the successful culmination of this story. Is that a fair assessment of what happened in the wake of Apollo 1?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it was a wake-up call to everybody about just, you know, small errors and design flaws and things that in isolation might be fine can accumulate and cause a complete a disaster. Kind of lit a fire under everybody who was working on this program, and they went back and they completely redesigned the Apollo capsule, and that became an incredibly successful vehicle that did several missions to the moon that turned out to be, you know, almost flawless, except for Apollo 13, which was a near disaster, but everybody got home safely. So, the possibility of a tragic accident happening on the moon or in orbit around the moon and losing somebody up there was averted. And, you know, one can imagine, but we would never look at the moon the same way again had something like that happen. So it was a terrible tragedy, but it was a wake-up call and really brought out the best of America's engineering prowess and technological prowess. And they built something really remarkable. It was an almost flawless machine.
Right. So this second chapter of your film, or second part, called Earthrise, ends with Apollo 8 successfully reaching the moon, and part 3 takes the story from there. One last pleasant surprise. I expected that part 3 was going to take us kind of methodically through Apollo 11 and 12 and 13 and 14 and 15 and so on. And I actually was thrilled that almost all of part 3 focuses on Apollo 11 itself. And yeah. I am sure that this story has never been told so thoroughly. What was most important to you in telling the story of Apollo 11 itself in a way that had not quite been told before?
Well, in the telling of Apollo 8, we had told that story through the point of view of the astronauts and their experience being the first human beings to go around the moon. I didn't want to do the same, tell the story the same way for Apollo 11, which was obviously the denouement, the great goal that had been laid out that the whole film is leading up to. So we tell Apollo 11 largely through the eyes of people on Earth and how we on Earth experience this moment on television. Because it was, as I was saying earlier, this was a television experience. And without television, it would have had a completely different meaning. It would have been, like somebody climbing Mount Everest and coming back down and saying, "Hey, I did it." It's a completely different thing. So we do have, we've got Mike Collins, got an interview with Buzz Aldrin, audio only. You don't see their faces. So we have that. But the central focus is of the drama is how we experienced it here on Earth.
Right. One of my favorite moments in part 3 is the jubilation that breaks out in NASA headquarters, the moment that they first see a picture being transmitted from the moon. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody screams, "We're getting a picture on the TV!" And it is this image. And I'd never seen that little moment before. And of course, it underscores the fact that if for some reason that connection had not worked, and if we had not been able to see those images all the way from the moon, so we could view this as it happened, it would have been a completely different experience. But that miracle of technology made all the difference in us being able to be, in a sense, participants in this extraordinary moment.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, it's kind of ironic for me. You know, we've got so much spectacular footage throughout the film, this beautiful color, absolutely and pristinely restored. It looks great. But I think my favorite piece of footage in the film is this grainy, ghost-like black and white image from the moon. It's almost if you did a scripted drama of, astronauts going to Pluto or something. You know, this is how you would do it. It's just, the fact that it was so grainy and ghost-like and you could, it just seems so remote and so far away, and the crackly voices of the astronauts, it was perfect. It's beautiful in a weird sort of low-tech way, and really makes you feel like something truly magical is happening that is very different from looking at pristine footage of what they were doing on the moon. And it has a certain immediacy and emotional resonance to me that is which is strange. Like, the worst quality footage in the entire film is my favorite.
And it puts us there. I mean, in a sense, it puts us on the moon, and it also puts us back 50 years to when people of Earth experienced this for themselves. One of many remarkable moments in this great film, again titled Chasing the Moon in three parts, A Place Beyond the Sky, Earthrise, and Magnificent Desolation, written, produced, and directed by Robert Stone. Mr. Stone, my congratulations on an absolutely wonderful film. I loved it, and I hope everyone will make a point of watching it and experiencing all of this as I did. I am very, very privileged to be able to speak with you, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. It was really great talking to you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you have to be a subscriber to the podcast to hear the morning show, because the studios will be dark because of the 4th of July. But via the morning show podcast, you can hear out of the archives a delightful conversation with Judith Martin, otherwise known as Miss Manners, and a wonderful book called Star Spangled Manners, in which Miss Manners defends American etiquette for a change. And on Friday's morning show, we'll be back in business on Friday with regular broadcast, and we'll have two interviews for you, including a memoir about somebody whose life was riddled with phobias, and another interview